SBS in deutscher Sprache.
Sie gilt als nationales Kulturgut, sie ist eine hochkarätige Künstlerin und man darf auch behaupten, dass sie die Königin des Kabarets hier in Australien ist, Robin Archer. Sie wurde mit dem Heltman Award for Best Cabaret Performer 2013 ausgezeichnet und trägt auch den Titel des Cabaret Idols am Adelaide Cabaret Festival 2016. Viele kennen sie auch als künstlerische Leiterin vieler Kunstfestivals, zum Beispiel in Canberra, Melbourne, Adelaide und Tasmanien. Robin Archer, sie hat bereits 12 Musikalben in ihrem Repertoire und sie schreibt auch Essays, Lieder fürs Theater und Kinderbücher. Und für die kommenden 3 Tage ist sie in Melbourne im Art Center mit ihrer neuesten Show «Dancing on a Volcano», ein Ausflug in die Kabarett-Szene der 20er und 30er Jahre in Berlin. Robin Archer, herzlich willkommen im Studio.
Guten Tag.
Was mir sofort ins Auge sprang, als ich Ihre Pressemitteilung las, war der Vergleich, den Sie anstellten zwischen der damaligen Zeit nach dem Ersten und vor dem Zweiten Weltkrieg mit heute. Wo sehen Sie Parallelen?
Well, I hesitate to say that it's an identical situation, but I do think the preconditions for a crisis are very, very similar. We know that, and this concert that we do, Dancing on the Volcano, has songs only from 1919, immediately after, more or less after the end of the First World War, to 1933. More or less when the National Socialists were in power and Adolf Hitler was elected as Chancellor. It's such a brief time of 14 years, and the concerts begin with light and fluffy songs by people like, some written by Bertolt Brecht himself. He played guitar and sang little funny ditties of Kurt Tucholsky, of Frank Wedekind, of people like this, who in whom you hear the songs being, thank goodness the war is over, we have a time to breathe. You go then to a period of 1927 when the Threepenny Opera was such a huge hit for Brecht and Weill. 5 years later, these artists could not remain in Germany. They could not express their opinions, and of course many who stayed were murdered. Many found exile in other places like England and America. So if one thinks about the conditions of that time, you have a stock exchange crash, which was probably the most devastating moment in Germany, and I'm sure your listeners know well the situation when the Deutsche Mark could buy nothing. There was deep poverty and starvation. And people felt disenfranchised from their government. This is already starting to sound a little bit like some places in the world today, particularly, I suppose, America. And a very strong, passionate orator came along and said to the people, I know how to fix this. He almost said in exactly those words, I will make Germany great again. And unfortunately was driven by, and I know what the problem is, and I know how to fix it. And we know what those consequences eventually had. So I think we do have a parallel situation at the moment where clearly the rise of populism within democracies, which is the most, you know, difficult thing to come to grips with, the rise of populism means that if you get strong rhetoric who paint very simple pictures and really misleading pictures, very simple solutions to incredibly complex questions and situations, desperate people will grab on that and they will go for it. And what we're seeing again and again, and it's just happened recently in Turkey, is that you have a populist leader who gets the popular vote and then starts to restrict freedoms and enhance executive powers. And you do have something the same. I hesitate, and I'm advised by some of the readings I'm doing at the moment about not drawing too tight a parallels between pre-war Germany and America at the moment. It won't work out exactly the same for sure, but certainly there are similarities. And you certainly hear that in the songs. More importantly, I suppose, rather than just drawing the parallels, is to say this was 14 years. be careful because you have no idea how quickly things can change. And in a couple of conversations I've been having recently, I draw more recent parallels. I was in the Faj Theatre Festival in Tehran. It was a very optimistic time. Young people thought it's all going to be okay. And within a very short time, it had completely turned around again. And we were doing, George Bertramlis and Michael Morley and I, were doing a concert in Hong Kong during the Umbrella Revolution. And it was filled with such optimism, such strong, lovely opinions. We walked around there and saw what was going on and how much art was employed. I think 2 weeks after we did the concert, they'd ripped the entire thing down and dispensed with it. So I suppose the message that comes through this lesson in nevertheless highly entertaining and beautiful song and music is don't be too complacent, especially now.
Ich sehe da noch eine andere Ähnlichkeit, weil das Kabarett in Deutschland, in Berlin in den 20er, 30er Jahren, gerade das politisch-literarische Kabarett, war nicht so erfolgreich wie sein Ruf, weil die Leute wollten eher unterhalten werden und diejenigen, die es sich leisten konnten, ins Kabarett zu gehen, waren genau gerade die Leute, die eigentlich von diesen Liedern angegriffen wurden. Also eine politische Passivität war damals schon vorhanden, so wie auch heute.
Yeah, that's a really perceptive comment because I think there's been a great deal of romanticization of Berlin Cabaret. I see a lot of performers do the kind of Liza Minnelli version of cabaret, the stockings and the top hat. And it's all about, it's more or less like a burlesque or a vaudeville, less about political commentary, etc. What's interesting about that moment is cabaret had really, of this kind, had really evolved in Paris in the 1880s. By the turn of the century, it had spread to Vienna, St. Petersburg, Zurich, Barcelona. It was everywhere. It got to Germany, Munich and Berlin. It got to these cities sort of in the teens and the 20s. And at the time when certain artists did want to make political commentary, it was a sort of ripe for that. But again, we can't over-romanticise that because although Brecht and Weill would have a main stage success with the Threepenny Opera, any political commentary went underground. Yes, you're absolutely right. These literary cabarets would go underground and with some very serious artists. I mean, Kurt Weill and Hans Eisler were serious composers making their contribution there. But it didn't last for long. I mean, it wasn't patronised by the large public, but it didn't last for very long. And as I said, they had to leave very quickly. One of the things, I'm making a speech this week on Thursday evening in Adelaide to open the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. And I've called this speech Freedom and Democracy, inspired by Brecht's poem, Freedom and Democracy, but looking at the current situation through a cultural lens. I found myself writing just a few days ago, did Brecht, Eisler, Tucholsky, Holländer, any of these stop the war? Did they stop the worst excesses? No, they didn't. But most importantly, we have the record of what they thought. So the fact that you can dip into, I mean, for me, Brecht's poetry is probably more compelling than any of the plays and the way many of the poems were turned into songs. Here, and it's Holländer, we do a song in the show called The Jews Are to Blame, highly satirical and actually still a bit dangerous to sing because when it starts, nobody knows where it's going, but you end up understanding perfectly that it is a huge satire and very critical, which he wrote before he left Berlin. At least in these artists, we have a record that these people knew what the right thing to do was, and it was really only at the point where imprisonment, prison camp or death was going to be the end. They had to get out to keep their work going. And to the credit of people like Brecht and Eisler, they returned for the reconstruction, even though, you know, the situation was very difficult. I suppose the parallel for me is, where are the artists who are doing that now? Even though we have the big hits and we have successful arts, who are the artists who are actually going on record as to their opinions? And there are a number of them. In my view, probably not quite enough. I do, interestingly, look at an artist like Tim Minchin, who has this huge success with Matilda, the musical, and with his big concerts. Tim has this massive audience globally, all over the world. Maybe it's, you know, 30,000 people every night of the week seeing different productions of Matilda, much loved. When he wants to write a political song, He wrote one about George Pell. He's written a couple of things. He goes into a small studio and within an hour he has something on YouTube which gets 12 million hits. He is kind of using YouTube as a version of the way cabaret worked in Berlin at that time, except the numbers are astronomical by comparison. So one can find a few. I look at an artist like an opera director like Peter Sellers, who is constantly working with both contemporary composers like John Adams, or working with very early work by Handel or Haydn, etc., to make contemporary political comments. So they are there, but I go back to that wonderful Brecht poem, which I recite somewhere, I think, in the show, called "In Dark Times," and it begins with something like, "They won't say when the walnut tree shook in the wind, but when the workers were being crushed. They won't say when the woman worked into the room, but there was starvation everywhere. They won't say, why are the times dark, but rather, why were their poets silent?" And I guess I look at the current situation and think, is everybody making sure that their record will make people understand in the future what we as human beings, as members of a society, thought about current difficult situations?
Im Studio ist Robin Archer und sie ist für die kommenden 3 Tage in Melbourne im Art Center mit ihrer neuesten Show Dancing on the Volcano. Ein Ausflug in die Kabarett-Szene der 20er und 30er Jahre in Berlin. Und Sie hatten vorhin ein paar Namen genannt, darunter natürlich Bertolt Brecht, Franz Wedekind, Ringelnatz, Holländer und so weiter und so fort. Alles große Namen aus dieser Szene. Singen Sie diese Lieder auf Deutsch? Und wenn ja, können wir eins davon jetzt hören?
I do sing a couple of the songs in German. Something like Friedrich Holländer's Falling in Love Again. It's known by so many people and the German is so absolutely irresistible. When it's a love song like that, then you don't need the English. What's interesting is that my late mentor, John Willett, who was the principal translator of Brecht into the English language and is largely responsible for introducing Brecht to Britain very, very, very soon after the Second World War. He edited most of the plays and he put together the huge collection of poems for Air Methuen Press. John, I accidentally met John when he became the dramaturg for the first production of the Threepenny Opera I was in, and he very much liked the way I sang the material. He started feeding me this material and invited me to the Royal National Theatre for a compilation show called To Those Born Later, which was to celebrate the publication of the poems in collection. John always said to me, if you are singing to an English audience, you must sing in English, because it's too easy. If you sing in German, people will simply get wrapped up in the beautiful melodies of Kurt Weill and they will have no idea what the texts are about. So you absolutely must make it clear as crystal what Brecht was saying. And this is, of course, the marvellous tension of these tunes, in that they're very, very tough lyrics set against magnificent jazz or beautiful, you know, some of Eisler's music. As the late songs are so like the Viennese school. They're almost Schubertian as leader. Beautiful, but you've got to hear the bite of Brecht's texts. The song that we'll sing for you today is also by Holländer. Its tune is so beautiful, and the German is so beautiful. I hope your listeners will forgive me for mashing it. My German is not perfect, but I have a go. It's irresistible not to. So in that instance, I kind of explain really what the song is about to the audience a little bit before I do it. But we love to do it because it's such a perfect song. And it comes a little bit later than midway through the program, and we do sing Falling in Love Again and a marvellous Holländer song called The Kitsch Tango, which is basically sending up Falling in Love Again. Yeah. But this Eine kleine Sehnsucht, it's got for me something of a prescient sadness. It's basically, you know, as your listeners will know anyway, but this idea, we've got to have a little daydream to get ourselves through. And there's just something, it's almost like the dancing, we've been dancing as hard as we can, but it's not helping. We're still a bit sad and we're daydreaming, and you almost get the sense that this is the little tiny calm before the storm.
Sie haben einen Teil Ihres Orchesters mit dabei.
Ja.
Am Akkordeon ist George Petromoulis. Dann hören wir jetzt von Friedrich Holländer eine kleine Sehnsucht.
Mein Tag ist grau, dein Tag ist grau, lass uns zusammen gehen. Wir wollen beide an den Händen uns fassen und uns so recht verstehen. Lang ist der Weg, bang ist der Weg, sicher wird man belohnt. Wir wollen recht fest an etwas Schönes denken und an ein Schloss im Mond. Meine kleine Sehnsucht braucht jeder zum Glücklichsein. Eine kleine Sehnsucht, ein Stückchen Sonnenschein. Eine Sehnsucht für den grauen Tag. Eine Sehnsucht, ganz egal wonach. Eine kleine Sehnsucht, ein flüchtiges Traumgebiet. Eine Sehnsucht, die sich niemals erfüllt. Lügen wir uns, trügen wir uns in eine Welt hinein. Und lass uns dann in diese Welt ganz verzaubert Prinz und Prinzessin sein. Du bist aus Gold, ich bin aus Gold, und unser Tag ist froh. Vergessen der Student im Dachstübchen und das Mädelchen vom Büro. Eine kleine Sehnsucht braucht jeder zum Glücklichsein. Eine kleine Sehnsucht, ein Stückchen Sonnenschein. Eine Sehnsucht für den grauen Tag. Eine Sehnsucht, ganz egal wonach. Eine kleine Sehnsucht, ein flüchtiges Traumgebiet. Eine Sehnsucht, die sich niemals erfüllt.
Wunderbar.
Dankeschön.
Wunderbar. Dankeschön. Im Studio ist Robin Archer und sie ist für die kommenden 3 Tage in Melbourne im Art Center mit ihrer neuesten Show Dancing on the Volcano. Robin Archer, wie haben Sie den Weg zum Kabarett gefunden? Was fasziniert Sie dabei?
It's a very interesting question. I'll go back where it begins in one sense. My father was a stand-up comedian and a singer. He was an MC, he was a compere. I've almost turned into my father, in fact, and my voice is placed almost exactly where his was. Dad, he put together variety shows. He did everything. He did weddings and parties and little shows, etc. He was really a variety performer. And so I suppose from really pre-teens age, I did my first gig with him when I was about 12. But I had been watching putting these shows together, and they were always a mix of light and shade, old and new, comedians, dancers, magicians, singers, dancers, etc. And so it was interesting for me that I went from there to singing various concerts to doing a bit of university review when I was at Adelaide University. And then when I eventually came back to Adelaide after a year working in clubs in Sydney. I came back to Adelaide, and a friend of mine, Justin McDonald, was at that time the administrator of something called New Opera, South Australia. This was a little company that had started in a living room, and they were Adelaide residents who really wanted to hear contemporary 20th century opera and music theatre. They weren't getting any of it, and they were doing these as parlour performances. So they wanted Stravinsky's Soldier's Tale, etc., etc. When the new Adelaide Festival Theatre was going up, they persuaded the first director there, Anthony Steele, that they would open the Space Theatre, that is the sort of experimental black box theatre, with the Australian premiere of The Seven Deadly Sins by Brecht and Weill. Justin and the company were wanting to sing the lead role, anyone, someone who was as untrained a singer as Lottie Lenya had been when Kurt Weill wrote that role for her, with her in mind. They didn't want somebody from the opera. They didn't want a trained formal singer. They wanted somebody who'd come, as it were, a little bit more from music hall or vaudeville. And Justin remembered me from university. So there I was. I really didn't know very... I knew nothing about Kurt Weill at the time. I knew a little bit about Brecht as a playwright, but really not much more. I went into that production singing with the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra to open the theatre. I'd never sung with an orchestra before. I couldn't read music. I had to learn the entire thing by ear. It was a huge success, and it completely turned my career around. 1 year later, the company brought John Willett from London to be the dramaturg of the Threepenny Opera. That's the point where John basically said, I like what you do, and he brought me to London, my first gig ever out of Australia, my first trip out of Australia, straight onto the stage of the Royal National Theatre singing Brecht. So from then on, it followed. Then I recorded the two albums of Robin Archer Sings Brecht at Abbey Road with the London Sinfonietta. And these people, and then Michael Morley, who had studied with Professor Michael Morley, who does these concerts with us, who was also the Professor of Drama at Flinders, Michael and John kept feeding me this repertoire. And it is endless, and I will never get through it in my lifetime. What's really curious on a personal level for me, my mother's family is a little bit Scottish, but mainly German. They came out to the Barossa Valley bringing the vines. My great-grandfather was born, they say, under a wagon with the vines in it that ended up in the Barossa, and that the branch of our family all went up to fruit blocks, soldier fruit blocks on the River Murray, where my mother was born on the banks there. So I have German heritage. All the time that I was going into, for a while I was billeted in East Berlin, and I attended the Berliner Ensemble. I did masterclasses with the great Gisela May and with Eckhard Schall. I was there. I was always advised at the time not to mention that I might have family in East Germany because it could cause some difficulties. And I was there many, many times. The first time I was there after the wall came down, we were doing a film called Solidaritätslied about Hans Eisler. And we were filming in East Berlin. And I had a day off. I hired a nice BMW and I drove down the highway because the family had, certain parts of the family had kept in touch with where my mother's family came from. It's a very small town called Tuchheim, which is between Magdeburg and Berlin. So I got this BMW, drove down the freeway, had a nice time, pulled into the little sign. The first sign I saw was identical to the sign on a plate in my mother's kitchen, and it was the plough and the motto, etc. And I drove in and I said to a man on the road, "Gib das hier Wörlings." He said, "Yeah, yeah, I feel a Wörlings," and pointed where the Wörlings, called here in Australia Walling, of course. Went to the house, knocked on the door, and saw immediately our little family book on the shelf and said, "This is me, this is my mother, this is where I'm." And of course, everyone broke out with this wonderful celebration. And a few years later, I was able to take my mother there to visit and use my bad German to translate. But it was a fantastic experience. What interested me most about it is that having learnt all the things that I learnt about this repertoire, this cabaret repertoire, in Adelaide, had suddenly brought me within 40, 50 kilometres of my family's origins. I just couldn't. The same had actually happened when I went to London to do the show A Star Is Torn. We opened in the Theatre Stratford East, the Royalty Theatre Stratford East. And I realised that that was probably the very theatre that my great-grandmother had actually watched performances in herself. And that was my dad's side of the family. In both cases, my career, almost unrelatedly, brought me within steps almost of my family's origins. It was just incredible. And since then, the answer really is the repertoire is so rich. As I said, I will never get through it in my entire lifetime. We keep introducing new, every time we do a show, we introduce new material. We're already planning one for next year, which is all about, particularly about exile, the people, their fortunes before they had to leave and then when they were in exile. It's so rich. As you began our interview, the repertoire is so pertinent every time. This show that we're doing in the Arts Centre, we've reintroduced from the Thrupney Opera, for obvious reasons, the Ballad of Sexual Obsession. Given the Me Too movement, you can't believe how relevant this song is at the moment. So there is always something, and I truly think that that's probably one of the best indicators of genuine artistry, is that whatever they're doing at whatever time, they actually do something that is so true somewhere, that it is always going to resurface in some way.
Schöne Geschichte. Robin Archer mit deutschen Wurzeln. Das hätten wir nicht gedacht. Robin Archer, danke für das Interview. Man wird Sie also sehen und hören vom Montag bis Mittwoch im Art Center in Melbourne, jeweils um 8 Uhr abends mit Ihrem Programm Dancing on the Volcano. Viel Erfolg. Besten Dank.
Dankeschön.
Kommentieren Sie unsere Inhalte. Liken Sie uns auf facebook.com/sbsgerman.